Welcome back, Question Medicine 2019. This is Andrew Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. You know the deal. It is Thanksgiving, or at least most of you are probably hearing this on Thanksgiving, which means we all have so much to be thankful for. There is so much to be thankful for, like free open access to medical education, free podcasts, free intellectual stimulation on your drive to work. Most of us do this not only for free, but we actually pay money to make this happen. There is a very select few of us that make any money doing this, and even the money we do make does not have us driving around Rolls Royce or putting on Rolexes, but maybe paying for an extra cup of Starbucks, if you will. So for all those individuals out there that do this for free, I am thankful for you, because I don't listen to myself on the way to work. I listen to you on the way to work. And if you listen to this podcast or any podcast on the way to work, I would encourage you to share it with a friend, because there is nothing better than having your podcast, the ones that you put hours and time and money into, that you put out there for free, have other people listen to it. So give it away. Tell people what you listen to. And if you don't listen to this, that's okay. Just tell people what you do listen to and what you enjoy. And with that, without further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Question Medicine 2019 Thanksgiving Day edition. We're going to make this short, sweet, to the point, because I got some turkey to make. I got the better brain to hang out with. We got the Cowboys on TV. It is time to do the Thanksgiving thing, if you will. So let's make this short, sweet, and to the point. Now, I will tell you openly, honestly, and with my own independent individual bias, I love DOAC. I think that the novel oral anticoagulants are amazing. I think that they are significantly better than warfarin, although I was a little late to that bandwagon, but they are definitely better than warfarin. Almost in all instances, your bans and trans, if you will, your dabigatran, your apixaban, your rivaroxaban, your edoxaban, the bans and trans, I think they're awesome in almost every situation, except for in this study titled Rivaroxaban versus Vitamin K Antagonist in Antiphospholipid Syndrome, a randomized non-inferiority trial. This is in the Annals of Internal Medicine, October 2019. And they took 190 adults. They randomized these 190 adults with antiphospholipid syndrome to either rivaroxaban or vitamin K antagonist, aka warfarin. And then they said, how often do you have a thrombotic event? And then how often do you bleed? And is it non-inferior? They followed them up for 3 years. And what do you know? What do you know? What do you know? Thrombotic events were almost 12% in those in rivaroxaban and only 6% in those with warfarin. Putting that differently, that's a 6% absolute difference, which means we're looking at a number needed to treat less than 20, which is huge. But what about bleeding? You say bleeding must be terrible. Well, it was 6.3 versus 7.4, so that's a 1% absolute difference, which makes worse bleeding for warfarin. So realistically, you're preventing about 6 clots for every 1 bleed that you cause with warfarin in those individuals over 3 years with antiphospholipid syndrome, compared to giving those same individuals rivaroxaban. I will tell you, at almost all instances in my life, including if I myself or the better brain or my family ever had AFib or a clot or a pulmonary embolism or some sort of thromboembolic event, I would be saying NOACs and DOACs, NOACs and DOACs. That's where we're going to go, except for if my family member had antiphospholipid syndrome, in which case it appears that warfarin, the vitamin K antagonist, is the superior king. And on to the next article in this paper in JAMA titled Association Between Levothyroxine Treatment and Thyroid-Related Symptoms Among Adults Age 80 Years and Older with Subclinical Hypothyroidism. Here is the deal. 80-year-old adults, 80 and older, with subclinical hypothyroidism. What's the association between the treatment with Synthroid or levothyroxine and thyroid-related symptoms? Because as you get older, almost certainly 100%, you're going to have thyroid-related symptoms, things like fatigue, tiredness. In fact, I am nowhere close to 80 years old, and I actually also suffer from fatigue and tiredness. So in this study, they took analysis of two randomized control trials where they basically took the individual trial and then subgroup analysis of patients within the trial. For those individuals aged 80 years and older, the mean age in the study was 85 years old. So this was nothing to mess with. These individuals were old. They were working with borrowed time, if you will. They are one of those individuals that we should say, listen, you're 85 years old. We know that the average age of death is somewhere in the 70s, depending what your comorbid conditions are and depending on the date that you were born. So you're working on borrowed time. You should not be buying green bananas, if you know what I'm saying. The patients were then randomized to receive either placebo or levothyroxine, and then they looked at the primary outcomes of the thyroid-related quality of life, patient-reported outcome questionnaire, which is basically ask you, are you tired? What are you doing? How do you feel? Do you have depression? Do you have all kinds of questions? But out of the 251 participants, it did not matter at all if you were randomized to placebo or to medical treatment for the fixing or the improvement of the number that is subclinical hypothyroidism. It appears that no matter how you cut it, the BMJ rapid recommendation, the guidelines, the evidence, it doesn't matter how you follow it. We should not be treating subclinical hypothyroidism in the elderly population. We just shouldn't do it because you don't feel any better. And again, there's no drug that doesn't have an effect. And whether that effect is just the cost of buying the drug and then getting a TSH and retesting and all that that goes with the monitoring of the drug to try to get it within quote range, which is such a ridiculous number anyways because TSH has such a wide range. It's so inaccurate. It really is just not worth it. We shouldn't be doing it. Let's not do it anymore. Let's put an end to it. And that leads us to the next article, which is one of my favorite studies I've seen in a really long time. It's one of my favorite studies because it answers a cool question, but the design of this study was absolutely phenomenal and one that I quite honestly have not seen, at least ever that I can remember, to be honest with you. This is, of course, in JAMA Internal Medicine, titled Association of Testosterone Therapy with Risk of Venous Thromboembolism Among Men with and Without Hypogonadism. This case crossover study design was used in which each man, each individual person that was in the study, each male with a VTE served as his own control. Yeah, think about that for a second. Each individual served as their own control within the own study. Within that study, they looked at almost 40,000 men that were cancer-free, had no reason to necessarily have a venous thromboembolism, other than the fact that they were prescribed testosterone. And that is the key deciding factor here, because they were trying to determine what is the relationship for testosterone to the VTE. And then they looked at 6 months, 3 months, and 1 month before the incident VTE event, and then looked at a control period, which was 7 months, 9 months, and 12 months from the incident VTE. All right, if you didn't quite follow that, let me try to break it down a little more simply because this is so cool what they did. Let's just hypothetically say you had your event on January 1st. They would then go back 6 months, so that makes it July 1st, and those 6 months from January 1st backwards to July 1st, those 6 months, that was your event arm. They were looking to see what happened in those 6 months. And then as the control arm, they would take you yourself, being you, your individual patient, and your control arm was the first 6 months of that previous year. So the control arm was January through June. The active arm that they were looking at was July through the end of December because you had your event on January 1st. And of course, they were looking at, as you can maybe tell already, the rates of VTE. And not only the rates of VTE, but what is the association of testosterone therapy with your risk of VTE? Meaning, in the previous 6 months, so if you had your event on January 1st, in the previous 6 months, going back to July 1st, were you prescribed or started on a treatment dose of testosterone? We know that testosterone makes you more likely to develop a clot. However, it doesn't mean that you're definitely 100% going to develop a clot. And some individuals that are on testosterone, we're going to develop a clot no matter what we did. They're just going to develop a clot. The number needed to harm is not one, and the number needed to treat is not one. So then in this trial, the men, again, acted as their own control arm. It is brilliant. This is observational data, but this is the best we can get. And the results, well, the results were easy. If you started on testosterone, you were more likely to have a VTE. You were more likely to have a venous thrombotic event. And I know many of you are saying, well, duh, obviously. Of course, we knew that. But by how much is the true question? Well, the answer is it depends, and it always depends. The answer is your risk almost doubles. You are almost double the risk of a VTE. But remember, it was 40,000 patients. So for example, we're looking at numbers like 59 VTE in 1 month, all the way up to 96 VTEs in 1 month out of 40,000 patients. This is still relatively and realistically very small numbers. I know that this sounds like a lot, and you might have to re-go back and play this whole part or this whole study again so you can kind of understand what they did here. But let me break it down a little bit. The odds ratio was 1.82, which is not only significant, but likely a very real and loud and clear signal that testosterone does cause VTE. But in the end, your risk jumps from numbers like 0.14% in 1 month if you're doing nothing. If you're not on treatment, you're doing nothing at all, you're just living your life, 0.14%. All the way up to, it skyrockets all the way up to 0.24%. A tenth of a percent is all that we're gaining. It's small, but it is significant, and it's at least worth telling your patient about, but probably not worth losing sleep over. All right, we're going to make this quick, and I'm going to wrap this up, but this next article, you should have your ears pinned to the sky. Maybe go back and listen to the previous article one more time, because it is actually a really important article to have the conversation with your patients about. But this next article, slow me down. Put me on half speed if you have to, because I will tell you, I truly believe that this next article is one of the top three, no doubt, articles of the year, maybe the top article of the year. And if you're going to argue that it's not one of the top three, it's certainly one of the top five articles of the year. This is huge. This is game changing. This is something that you should do tomorrow. So listen closely. Here we go. And of course, I am talking about this article in European Heart Journal titled Bedtime Hypertension Treatment Improves Cardiovascular Risk Reduction, the HIGA Chronotherapy Trial. What on earth did I just say? Well, let's talk about it. When we give blood pressure medications, often the patient will ask us, well, doctor, what time of day should I take the medication? And usually, I'll be honest, my answer to them is, I don't care. Just take it. Make sure you take it. Don't forget to take it. Please just take your medication. Because I figure if they're taking their medication, what more can I ask for? Who really cares what time of day it is? Does it matter if it's 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 8 o'clock at night, 9 o'clock at night? Does it really matter? Well, this study set out to answer that exact question. It was a multi-center prospective chronotherapy trial that compared outcomes in over 19,000 patients assigned to one or more hypertension medications at bedtime or upon wakening. So you could take your medications at night or take it in the morning. And they did really cool things. Like they said, all right, they called you and said, go put your medications by the alarm clock so that way you know to take it at night. Or go put your medications by the toothbrush so that way you do it first thing in the morning. Or by the toilet or by the cup of coffee in the morning. Or whatever you do first thing in the morning, go put your medications there. And they would call and remind you. And it was just really neat the way that they would try to do this. And there were no specific medications. They didn't tell the providers, listen, out of these over 19,000 patients, you have to give an ACE, you have to give an ARB, you have to give a beta blocker, you have to give a hydrochlorothiazide, clothalidone, you name the drug. They didn't say it. It was come one, come all. It was just like we do in real practice. Everyone has their own medications that they prescribe, their own tinctures of time. And realistically, the drug that you're most likely to prescribe today is the drug that you're were or you did prescribe yesterday. because you remember the dose. It's not that it's a better drug, and realistically, it's probably not, because there are very few head-to-head trials that tell us which drugs are better, so we can't really say that. It's just that you remember the dose, and so inertia takes over, and you write for the same drug over and over. Which is, again, what I love about this trial is they didn't control which drugs were being used, just the time of day for which you took those drugs. Now, of these patients, they followed them up for just over 6 years. And during that time, the patients had to do ambulatory blood pressure monitoring for at least 48 hours each year, which is kind of a pain, but it's impressive that they were able to get so many individuals to do it. The primary outcome was cardiovascular disease endpoint, defined as a composite of cardiovascular death, coronary revascularization, heart failure, myocardial infarction, and stroke. Basically, they want to know, are you having a heart attack, are you having heart failure, are you having death, or are you having a stroke? Those are really good endpoints. In the end, the results showed an overwhelming benefit, and this is where the shocker comes in those individuals that had bedtime dosing. Meaning, if you were randomized to take your medication at night, the reduction was huge, in hazard ratio of 0.55, meaning a 45% reduction compared to those individuals who took their blood pressure medications each morning. This is for hard outcomes like death, stroke, and heart attack. And normally, I am a huge just killer. I want to just put it in a stroke hold. I want to put it in a stranglehold, these composite outcomes. I hate it. But their secondary endpoint was each individual one by themselves, meaning they looked at what did stroke do by itself? What did cardiovascular death do by itself? What did myocardial infarction do by itself? What did coronary revascularization do by itself? And normally, out of these huge composite outcomes, you see something like coronary revascularization being the main reason that the whole composite outcome was statistically significant, because you'll have these huge effects on something like coronary revascularization, which is such a BS endpoint, because you could ask 9 different cardiologists, and unless it's a true clear STEMI, you're going to get 9 different answers on whether a blood vessel needs to be stented, whether they actually need the catheterization or not. Same thing with heart failure. You can ask 9, 10, 12 different individuals, and you're going to get different perspectives on heart failure and heart failure hospitalizations. So usually these relatively weak outcomes are what drives the whole composite outcome, but not this time, my friends. No. Things like stroke, 50% reduction. Cardiovascular death, over a 55% reduction. Myocardial infarction, 40% reduction. These were huge. When we're looking at a 40 to 60% reduction in those individuals randomized to nighttime medication, we have to listen, because I will tell you, we're not adding new medications. We're not giving new side effects necessarily. We're not prescribing new drugs. It's not going to cost us anymore. We're doing what we're already doing and just saying, hey, by the way, you should go ahead and take this at night. Don't take it in the morning. And you get a 40% reduction. Realistically speaking, that is a larger reduction than probably the addition of some of our medications. Sure, during the first medication, if their blood pressure is 180, 190 systolic, the first blood pressure medication, you're definitely going to get a 50, 60, 70% reduction in their hard outcomes. But each additional drug that you're adding, you're getting such minimal benefit. But it does appear you're getting a huge benefit if you just tell them to take the medication at night before they go to bed. Now, normally I would also end this by saying, with every up comes a down, with every in goes an out, with every tide rolling in, there's a tide rolling out. The ball goes up, the ball's got to come back down. But let me tell you, as far as adverse effects, there was no increase in adverse effects in the bedtime group. The rates were 6.7 for the daytime group and 6.0 for the bedtime group. This is truly a game changer, and I will end you with that little nugget, little pearl, little gem of wisdom that will hopefully change your practice starting tomorrow. It is certainly a paper worth being thankful for. So with that, let me wrap this up as I've ended every podcast before. In 30 seconds or less, let's talk about the papers that we've talked about here. First of all, if you are going to prescribe an individual with antiphospholipid syndrome anticoagulation, then you should give warfarin, not rivaroxaban. If you are looking at an individual that's over the age of 80, has subclinical hypothyroidism, and you're debating, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? The answer is do not treat them with medication, at least not for the subclinical hypothyroidism. They don't need it. They're not going to benefit from it. What about testosterone therapy? What about testosterone therapy? Well, it almost doubles your risk of a venous thromboembolism. However, the risk is so small at baseline. It's 50 per 40,000 people per month, and it jumps up to 90 per 40,000 men per month. So yes, it is real. It is significant, but it is still very small. And last but not least, oh yes, oh yes, oh yes, if you're writing for a blood pressure medication, whether the patient asks you or does not ask you, when do I take this medication? You should tell them you should take it at night before you go to bed, because it just might save your life or prevent you from having a heart attack or prevent you from having a stroke with a 40-point reduction compared to those individuals who took the medication in the morning. And with that, I will end this podcast as I have ended every podcast before it. Wait for the music. And there you go. There it is. There it is. Until next time, Keith Quest and Questioning.